From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, even as more signs point to an emergency manager appointment coming sooner rather than later, Detroit's mayor readies his State of the City speech.
He's got to get public safety under control and soon, and I hope the bulk of his speech deals with public safety.
Plus, we'll look at why most of America is not embracing electric vehicles.
What are we driving around today? Basically the same internal combustion engine with some improvements that we were driving 100 years ago.
And we'll take you to the Stockbridge School District, a tiny district doing a lot of things right.
And I think it's important to look at what a traditional public school is doing in the face of all this changing educational policy and shrinking funding.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. On our show today, we look at sales of alternative energy vehicles in our country. As much as the government wants us to get into EVs and other alternative energy vehicles, the American consumer is not warming up to them. Just what's keeping us from embracing the EV? But first, Detroit's mayor will be delivering his State of the City address this coming Wednesday night. Even as Dave Bing prepares his speech, the time may be near for Governor Snyder to lower the proverbial boom and announce the appointment of an emergency manager for Michigan's biggest city. Detroit News editorial writer Nolan Finley joins us now. Nolan, your column in the Sunday News really seems to point to action from Lansing sooner rather than later. What's the latest you're hearing from Lansing?
Well, what the latest I'm hearing is that the governor has made an offer to his preferred emergency manager candidate and is just awaiting to hear from him and or her, and that they expect a answer midweek, sometime this week.
And are you getting any sense of who that first choice may be?
No, I was only told that it was an out-of-state person, and it wasn't Anthony Williams, who was the governor's first choice. He's the former mayor and former emergency manager of Washington, D.C., so he's got some good experience on both sides of this thing.
Nolan, what do you feel is making the pieces fall into place at perhaps what one might say is a more accelerated pace?
Worsening financial condition in the city. I think the review team, which should have its report done by the end of the week, finding a lot more ominous signs for the Detroit budget, Detroit long-term fiscal health. Plus, the governor's up against this March 27th date when the new emergency manager law kicks in. Any emergency manager in place at the time the law kicks in will be automatically transferred over to the powers and authorities of the new law. If he waits until after March 27th, the whole process has to start over again. The whole review process has to begin anew, which backs everything up again a few more months.
Nolan Finley, give us a deeper sense, if you can. I know the financial review team has been doing that deep dive into the city's books. And tell us more about what you're hearing about, what they're finding. And then there are the three consulting firms that have been hired to handle restructuring. So what are they finding as they dig in there?
I'm hearing that the pension liability shortfall is much greater than was expected. And so that adds to both the long-term situation and the short-term ability to meet the pension payments. They've got to do something with this $12 billion in debt. And the thought is that you need a fiduciary, a single individual who doesn't have to go through the political process to get every step approved, who can negotiate with creditors and say, look, here's what we're going to give you. Will you take this deal or not take this deal? And if you don't take this deal, we're probably going into bankruptcy. I know that Miller Buckfire, the consulting firm out of New York, is busy producing a turnaround strategy that can either be submitted as part of a bankruptcy filing or handed to the emergency manager and said, hey, implement this the best you can.
Was any of the timing or what seems to be the growing signs pointing to imminent appointment, did any of that stem out of the way that City Council, will say, handled the Belle Isle offer from the state?
We asked the governor that question on Friday, and he did commend council and the mayor for some recent steps they've taken to move this process ahead a little more quickly. But he said it would have all been better had they done it months ago. Now the time frame for getting things in place is much shorter, and he's going to have a whole lot of confidence in their ability to keep making the right decisions to not appoint a manager by March 27th and risk having to start everything all over.
I guess I'd like your thoughts on this, if I could, Nolan. I've been reading a lot of comments online and letters to the editor back and forth on this issue. And what is your answer to those letters from readers that read, in essence, why, after, especially after Belle Isle, why should we care anymore about what happens to Detroit? My town, my city, has enough of its own challenges.
Well, and there is that sense of folks becoming weary of this ongoing drama, and that Detroit has resisted help, good help that was answered or offered. And you can understand that folks are starting to wonder or come to the conclusion that, well, if you don't want help, then fix it yourself, rise or fall on your own merits, your own ability. But I don't know that we can afford to let that happen. I think that's what the governor is looking at, and is looking at that fixing Detroit and getting Detroit healthy is essential to the state of, to the health of Southeast Michigan and the rest of the state.
Nolan, what will you be looking for from Dave Bing on Wednesday with the State of the City address?
Well, I hope he talks about nothing but public safety on Wednesday. You see the front page of the Detroit News today talking about violent crime up, arrest down. The police department is an absolute mess. The lack of public safety, the mess in the emergency medical service vehicles, all of those vehicles being out of service and in disrepair, those are deciding factors when people are looking at whether to stay in Detroit or leave. He's got to get public safety under control, and soon. And I hope the bulk of his speech deals with public safety. I mean, everything else is just a distraction. You cannot have a city with so much violence and so much unaddressed violence.
Nolan Finley, Detroit News, good talking with you. Thanks so much for joining us today on
Stateside. Thank you, Cynthia. I appreciate it.
In other news from Detroit, after nearly 70 days of testimony, a federal jury heard closing arguments today in the corruption trial of former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick. A federal prosecutor told jurors that Kilpatrick turned City Hall into, using his words now, a private profit machine. The ex-mayor is charged with 30 crimes, including bribery, conspiracy, extortion, and tax violations. Some allegations go back to Kilpatrick's time as a state lawmaker before he was elected Detroit's mayor in 2001. Prosecutors say Kilpatrick shook down contractors and his own political fundraiser, and that he turned a nonprofit civic fund into his personal slush fund. He denies any wrongdoing. His father, Bernard, and his close friend and city contractor, Bobby Ferguson, are also on trial. Jury deliberations probably will not start until Wednesday. All week long, Michigan Radio is airing a special series of reports exploring the schools and the educational opportunities in Stockbridge. It's part of the State of Opportunity Project. Stockbridge is a village about midway between Ann Arbor and Lansing. Like so many towns and villages around Michigan, the economy's taken a beating, industry's gone, and the school system is one of the few ways that kids from Stockbridge can get a leg up. Just what can be learned from this rural town and its efforts to make sure that its kids get a good education, even in the face of shrinking state aid and a tough economy? Sarah Alvarez from the State of Opportunity team joins us now. Welcome to Stateside. Good to have you, Sarah.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, tell us why the choice to focus on Stockbridge?
I think that Stockbridge is like a lot of districts in Michigan. It is a rural district. Industry is gone, like you said. And that's the case with so many places around here. It really hasn't recovered from the Great Recession. And so in those places, people are very reliant on the public schools, and there isn't any other choice in Stockbridge. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not charter schools. There's not private schools. Kids can do online learning, but just a little bit, you know. So that's the only game in town, and I think it's important to look at what a traditional public school is doing in the face of all this changing educational policy and shrinking funding.
How many students in the district?
There's about 1,500 students in the whole district. It's a 1 mile town. A village is 1 mile, but it's a changing town. And Nick Roberts was one of the youth journalists that worked with me on this project. And he gives us an audio postcard, a view into one of the places that is the hangout in Stockbridge.
We are at McDonald's in Stockbridge. Stockbridge is incredibly small. We have one intersection with a stoplight. It's not even a stoplight, it's just a blinking red light up above. We have three restaurants, two of which are more directed towards the elderly, so the teens, we don't want to go there, so we come to McDonald's. We come hang out, we do homework, we just chill. I mean, there's lots of times where we don't even buy anything, we'll just hang out. This is Gabe Schrey.
Once I got a Saturday detention coming to McDonald's.
He's 18.
Well, I mean, on a weekday, you know, usually after school, I mean, as you're walking out of school, you see your buddies, say, hey, after school, you want to hang out? And if you tell your friends you're going to hang out after school, there's a 50% chance you're going to go to McDonald's, because unless you're going to someone's house, there's nowhere else to go in Stockbridge or in town.
I mean, it's not just high school students that hang out here. Everybody comes here. Oh, those are the morning special. There are two groups of elderly that come in the morning. There's usually a 6 a.m. group who comes get their coffee, but it's, many of them return at 9 o'clock to get another coffee. I actually know quite a few. One of them is Donnie Lewis, a good friend of mine. Since I started writing the story, I got a job here. And everyone here is really friendly. I mean, everyone knows everybody. And it's just a lot of fun, actually. Even though I work here, I still come here and hang out. Hanging out in the Stockbridge McDonald's. This is Nick Roberts.
That's great. And so Nick is a student, and I think the key to what makes your report so special is how you tell us how you pulled the kids in to become a part of this.
Well, I was very lucky to work with a teacher named Elizabeth Sear, and she teaches journalism classes there. So I worked with her beginner journalism students and then a couple of them who had worked on the paper before. But most of these kids, actually, this was kind of their first introduction to journalism. So I ended up working with 17 students to produce pieces. Some of them wrote for the web, and some of them did audio diaries like Nick's, and I think they give us a view into Stockbridge that we couldn't get any other way. And working with these kids was phenomenal.
Thanks, Sarah. Stay with us. We're going to continue our conversation about the efforts Stockbridge is making in its schools to give every one of its students an excellent education. Many things are working well for both teachers and students, and that includes a focus on science and math. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing our conversation now with Michigan radio reporter Sarah Alvarez. She's part of the State of Opportunity team. And all this week, she's bringing us a series of reports exploring the schools and the educational opportunities in Stockbridge, Michigan, a very tiny village. But Sarah, you say Stockbridge schools are producing some very high-achieving students?
They are, and I think that that is what is so interesting about Stockbridge. They are high achieving, their schools perform better than the state average, and the demographics would not lead you to believe that that could happen.
Why do you think it is? What's happening that's so good?
I think it is a small system. It's very well run. The superintendent is very well liked. The principals of the schools are very well liked and well respected. Teachers are very engaged and I think they have a lot of room to experiment. So they feel continuously challenged in a way that, is rewarding. It's always challenging to be a teacher, but I think that there's a lot of kind of professional development that they can do because it's small, because they have the backing of the administration, they can get projects through that that are interesting to them.
It sounds like they can be a lot more nimble. They can just respond to needs and get it done.
I think so, but it's also a school district that doesn't have very much money. So I think it's impressive that they can do that because population is shrinking, property taxes are low. So it is a school district that is run very close to the bone economically, and over 40% of the kids in that district are free and reduced lunch. So, I think the gains that they have made are pretty impressive. But I also think there are probably school districts like it all over the state, and we just don't know about them because they're small towns.
And so it's a chance to really shed a light on what they're doing. Certainly, as you look around in the world of education, all signs point to the STEM skills, the science, technology, the engineering, the math-based skills, as being so important for the jobs of the future. So tell us, how Stockbridge preparing its kids for these jobs?
That's one of the things that I think, one of those kind of special projects that teachers and principals have put into being there. They really focus on STEM at almost at every level. So in the elementary school, they have an exploratory academy, which is a hands-on learning environment for third, fourth, and fifth graders. It's almost all hands-on learning. And it is very impressive to see little girls and little boys making hovercrafts to learn about torque, and to hear eight-year-olds say torque and talk about buoyancy instead of something floating. I think they're really getting in there and they're really understanding complex concepts. And they are having a lot of fun, the teachers and the students. And then there's a very impressive underwater robotics program in Stockbridge. They build underwater robots and they take them to competitions and they take them out in the field to actually do work. And that's trickling down all through the school system. The elementary students are doing that. They're starting this year to try to incorporate into the middle school, which is a place where I think it's harder to innovate. There's a lot of STEM education going on there. And then the high school has a really broad array of technical classes for career training. And unlike a lot of places, those technical classes are for everyone. Students and teachers alike will tell you that kids do not track themselves as like, I'm going to college, or no, I'm going into a career.
Voc ed.
Exactly. It is very modern. They do, you know, alternative energy classes. They build wind turbines, but they also do a lot of work on cars. And kids who are going to college take those classes.
And it strikes me as you're talking, Sarah, that you say it starts young and you talk about the boys and girls together. So when it's starting young, it's just part of their vocabulary and part of their mindset. And it isn't something that gets introduced later where they have math fear, for instance.
I think so. And I think we're really going to see a change in the coming years in Stockbridge because they're now starting so young. So they've always been very strong at the high school. And now they're starting at the elementary level. So I think when those kids come to high school, the things that they're going to be able to do are going to be very impressive. We'll hear from another one of the youth journalists, Alex Wilson. He got started doing computer programming between, I think he says, 6th and 7th grade. And, you know, now he's working with people, you know, in other countries.
Wow. Let's take a listen to Alex Wilson.
I'm Alex Wilson. I'm 16, a junior at Stockbridge High School, and I'm sitting in front of my computer at 9:50 because I'm programming. On school nights, I usually work at my computer until around 10:30. My parents will sometimes have to tell me to go to bed during the summer because I stay up so late working. I usually listen to techno music like Daft Punk while I'm working because it just kind of keeps my ears occupied and lets me focus. Often while I'm programming, I will jot things down or sketch things out on note cards, and they're pretty much all over my desk. I've been doing programming since the summer between 6th and 7th grade. I was given 2 programming manuals at a neighbor's garage sale, one of which I read pretty much cover to cover. My friends in Stockbridge know that I do programming, but none of them do it themselves. There are a few people currently working with me. One of them lives in Ontario, and the other one in Chicago. I'm working on a project which aims to create an alternative to gaming consoles like the Xbox or PlayStation. We all contribute in our spare time. Me when I'm not in school, and them when they're not working. My dad's an IT guy, and he works with computers for a living. He never pushed me to go down this path, but he really has helped me grow as a programmer. This summer, I do plan on doing freelance work to start saving up for college. I do enjoy physics, and I'm considering pursuing a career in it, which would definitely involve using the computer skills I've taught myself. Stockbridge Schools offers a lot of opportunities for science, technology, and math, but I sort of take my own path when it comes to programming. I don't go to the programming training offered at the Career Center in Lansing, and even though I did take one class for programming as a freshman, at the time of taking it, I was already pretty well versed in the concepts being taught. I'd really like to work with stuff like the Xbox Kinect motion capture and voice recognition, because I think there's a lot of promise in that area. Plus, it's just really fun to tell a computer what to do by shouting at it and waving your arms around.
This is not a young man who's going to have a problem finding employment when he gets out of school.
I hope not.
No, he certainly has it. And I think that idea that I'm hearing this theme of really having high expectations for at-risk kids is so key.
I think so. They focus a lot in the elementary school. They use a program called Response to Intervention. They got a state grant to pilot the program about 6 years ago. And it is based on the idea that, you know, if you help kids harness their energy and control themselves, that they will learn better and that reading scores will go up and math scores will go up. And they found that to be the case. So that is where those expectations start. And the expectations for at-risk kids are very high. And the expectations for everyone is high. I mean, even in the alternative high school, which mm-hmm. is really just a room kind of off the middle school, and that's for kids, it's the last-ditch effort to try to keep kids in the school system,
right?
Kids who have not succeeded in the high school. They had 9 graduates from the alternative high school last year, and 5 of them are getting additional education at community college or in the military. I mean, it's impressive that even for those kids, you know, there is still more education and that those kids still value education.
And none of that costs money. It's a mindset, isn't it? It isn't a budget line item. It's a mindset that there's no price tag on that.
I think so. I think, though, that the people in Stockbridge will tell you, though, that they are very worried about their ability to continue to provide a high-quality education because the budget is just so pinched. I mean, they've been cutting and cutting for years. And there is additional aid from the state this year, but it's going to be probably budget neutral for them. So, I mean, I think they are worried that what they've been able to do with very few resources, that they're going to be able to continue to do that.
So we're going to have a lot to absorb as we listen to your reports all week long here on Michigan Radio. But we have one last audio postcard, and this is Gabe.
This is Gabe Schrey. He is one of the youth journalists, and he is also in my story on middle school, because in middle school, he was a little bit of a disaster, as he will tell you. His grades were bad. He did not have any self-confidence, and he had a very tough time. He really pulled it together. He is going to college next year. He is well-liked. He is well-respected, and he's happy. So this is kind of his story of how he pulled it together and how football helped him do that.
Stockbridge High School senior Gabe Schrey and Sarah Alvarez produced this audio postcard. Thank you for listening.
Chelsea, please come to the office.
All the way through middle school, I was bullied. You know, I got pushed around by everyone. I didn't care about my classwork at all. And when I was in seventh grade, my grandfather passed away in front of me. And I had to leave the care of my grandmother and move in with my dad in this brand new place, which was Stockbridge. So my freshman year, I came into high school, and in the first semester, it was like nothing had changed at all for me. At the time, I was probably around, you know, 270 pounds, maybe 280. So I thought to myself, how can I change this? And my solution was to begin trying to fend for myself. So I began to work out on a daily basis, and I started dieting. Well, the varsity center, John Grassmeyer, started to pressure me to come out and play football. And I was really, really bad at football. And even though everybody was doubting me and, you know, giving me a hard time, I stuck with it. And that's why that offseason I just began to train like no other. I just started training daily, every morning. I'd get up at like 5 in the morning and run, lift weights. Coach Killinger, as promised, showed up. As time went on, I really got to know Coach Killinger, and the more I got to know him, the more I looked up to him. He does not consume alcohol, smoke, swear. He is a very religious man. Carl Heidrich was my position coach, and I really looked up to him. He's also the principal of the high school. Anyhow, sometime in the beginning of the season, he was standing in front of all the linemen. And he says,
we're going to have to work pretty hard to make this line function this season. Then he pointed me out, and he said, look at this guy right here. In this offseason, this guy has doubled everything about him. His strength, his size, his speed. The way he talked about me in front of everyone like that, it really encouraged me. During our daily tackling drills, I was carrying the ball, and one of my teammates tackled me. When he hit me, he landed on my leg, and as soon as it happened, I knew something was wrong. I dislocated my left knee and broke my left fibula, and it was just total heartbreak for me. I cried on homecoming probably 3 or 4 times, and it was just, I've never worked for anything in my life like I've worked to be a good football player. And if I hadn't started playing football, I have no idea where I'd be right now. I wore the number 90 in black and orange, and I'd like to think that I did that number proud. And though I've only had one real offer to play at the next level, you never know what'll happen.
Fantastic. Sarah working with over 15 youth journalists from Stockbridge High School to bring the Stockbridge Project to the airwaves. We can't wait to hear what you have to have all week long, Sarah.
Thanks so much.
Then the Stockbridge series of reports will be airing during Morning Edition and All Things Considered all week long here on Michigan Radio. It's all part of Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project, looking at ways to break the cycle of poverty and to build opportunities for Michigan's most disadvantaged children. So let's continue talking about what's working in education here in Michigan and what is not. Are we failing our kids in vocabulary instruction? According to a new study published in Elementary School Journal, the vocab lessons our kids are getting in grade school fall woefully short of giving students the range and the scope of words they need to become good, effective readers throughout their lives. Here to talk about the study and what it could cost our kids to be saddled with a deficient vocabulary is the lead researcher, Tanya Wright. She's an assistant professor of teacher education at Michigan State University. She joins us now from East Lansing. So just what caused you to want to take this closer look at vocabulary education?
Well, really, there are two reasons to be interested in vocabulary. Most importantly, like you already said, we know that vocabulary is incredibly predictive of children's reading comprehension. The other reason we're really interested in vocabulary instruction is because there's evidence that children arrive at school with differences in their vocabulary knowledge based on their socioeconomic status.
Okay.
So children from low-income homes, there's evidence that by toddlerhood, they may already know less vocabulary than their middle-income peers. So what we really need is schools to make sure that they're addressing vocabulary so that these kids don't fall behind in their reading comprehension.
Mm-hmm. And close the gap, because, again, you're looking at predictors of lifetime success.
Exactly. So reading comprehension is really about school success and lifetime success.
Well, the headline of the Michigan State University report on your study is Vocabulary Instruction Failing U.S. Students. So it sounds like the state of things across the country isn't very terrific.
So what we did is we looked at comprehensive language arts curricula that are used commonly across the country. So these are going to be your curricula that represent the entire language arts experience that children get in their school.
So are we talking K through 12?
I was looking at kindergarten because we wanted to see how schools were doing this with this right at the start.
Mm-hmm.
And so we took a look in detail at what these curricula are doing as far as vocabulary development.
And what did you find?
What we found is a broad range in what the curricula provide. But on the low end, we found one curricula that only taught 2 words per week. So that's it.
2 words per week?
Right.
What's a ideal number of words per week?
So researchers typically say 400 to 1,000 words per year.
All right.
So that's going to be about anywhere between 10 and 50 a week.
And we're talking with little ones.
Yeah, we're talking about little ones.
Mm-hmm.
And remember that little ones can learn words through experiences, right? So you're doing a science experiment with them and you're teaching them the words that are relevant to science content, or you're reading a book aloud to them and you're teaching the words that are relevant to that text. So we're not talking about flashcards and drill. We're still talking about appropriate instruction for the age group, but we are trying to increase the words that they know, both the breadth and the depth of their word knowledge to support comprehension of texts.
How much of a priority is vocabulary and language arts in teacher education when the teachers of America are being trained?
Well, we want to make it a priority, mm-hmm. right? We want to make sure that teachers leave the door ready to go to the classroom, ready to provide vocabulary instruction. And in particular, we know that our newest teachers are most likely to be in the schools that serve children from low-income backgrounds. So we really want to make sure that when teachers leave their teacher education program, this is something that they're prepared to do.
I'm going to just kind of imagine, and you're talking about these lower-income districts and students, that there could be a single parent who is trying to hold down a couple of jobs, and you know, reading books doesn't happen at home.
Well, exactly. Well, that's why our focus is so much on school, right?
Yeah.
Because if schools understand that there are families with different circumstances and children arriving at our school door with all different sorts of backgrounds and vocabulary knowledge, we want to make sure they're going to be successful in school, in their reading comprehension, and have long-term success. So it falls on schools to make sure that they're doing a really, really good job with this important area.
I wonder, can parents do more in just the way that they talk to their children and their little ones from the time they're babies?
Definitely. I mean, we know some baby talk or the mm-hmm. tone that we talk to kids in is really to engage them, right? So mm-hmm. that's going to be important for little kids. But definitely talking to children, describing what's going on to children, giving them words when they might not have them themselves. Always use the big word. Don't use the baby word, because why not? They can. In some of the curricula we've done, even with preschool children, we teach kids big words like ferocious, like hypothesis. And these little 3 and 4-year-olds can use these words. And why not? That's the correct word for the situation.
Tanya Wright, Assistant Professor of Teacher Ed at Michigan State University, on the study published in Elementary School Journal on our vocabulary instruction. Thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure.
Coming up next, why America is not embracing electric vehicles. This is Stateside, and you're listening to Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The auto industry certainly seems to be roaring back to life, but there does not seem to be a lot of buzz surrounding alternative energy vehicles. And that's being reflected in sales. January figures were anemic at best for electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids. The Obama administration had predicted 1 million electric cars would be scooting around on our highways by 2015. Today, there are barely 30,000. Just why aren't these vehicles catching on with the public? Is there anything the automakers can do to make EVs and plug-ins more appealing? Joining us is Dr. Sean McAlinden, who's the Executive VP of Research, and he's the Chief Economist at the Center for Auto Research. And David Shepherdson is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. David, start by giving us a recap of those January sales figures for electric vehicles and the plug-in hybrids.
Well, it was pretty grim. Sales were off across the board about 50% or more for the major plug-ins and EVs, the Nissan Leaf, Chevy Volt, and Toyota Prius plug-in. And it looks a little worse than it really is, in part because many buyers pulled ahead their purchases in December because of the $7,500 tax credit. But it still does not mask the entire problem, which is that Americans still think they're generally too expensive. They're too unsure about the range, especially with pure EVs. And gas prices have, although at a record high in 2012, we're not seeing the kind of spikes we saw back in 2008, which really scared people and shifted them away from SUVs and trucks back then. And now it's a little, the reality is people are not shifting dramatically and certainly not making the big jump to EVs because of gas prices. And at least in the short term, it doesn't look like sales will get dramatically better.
I know Nissan CEO Carlos Ghosn called the Leaf sales a disappointment for us. Sean, would you say that feeling's being echoed in executive offices at the other automakers?
Absolutely. I'm afraid that most of the major automakers that we work with speak to don't really believe the pure electric cars will ever probably reach 1% of the market. They got a little more than a third of 1% last year by 2025. You know, hybrids are a different story. With electrics, they kind of helped capture 3.1% of the market last year. But frankly, on hybrids, that really does depend on the price of gasoline, mm-hmm. Which even if it was a record last year, wasn't enough to you know, really spur a lot of hybrids. There are some new mild hybrids that are doing well that aren't as expensive as the traditional ones. But, you know, overall, I think on the pure electrics, I'm afraid we're looking at another early mortality for the electric car, you know.
Interesting. So. What is not happening to make the American public embrace the electric car?
Well, one, obviously, is cost. Mm-hmm. Two, the infrastructure isn't there to support electric cars. And third, and most important, is customer acceptance, the big worry on fuel economy technologies. You know, the range is limited, unreliable, depending on the weather or how hard you use the car. The recharge time is incredibly inconvenient. The transportation, motor vehicles are a path-dependent product. People are used to the way they drive, how they use their vehicle, what it can do, what it feels like. And electric cars violate all of these rules. And it's just not going to change enough in the next 15 years to really save that product. I can see why the administration put $7.5 billion behind it.
And that's what I wanted to get into
with
both of you. When you think of the federal subsidization that went in for the battery suppliers and the producers of EVs, and has the federal government stumbled, in your opinion, by plowing so much money into alternative fuel vehicles, Sean?
I can see why the Japanese bet on hybrids, the Europeans bet on diesels, our government up until this administration bet on nothing. And right now, actually, we see each automaker pursuing a very different path to get to that higher fuel economy target, which means that some will fail, some will succeed, and the scale economy, as we call it, may not happen. And some companies want to downsize their motors and turbocharge them. Some want to stick with hybrids. Some want to upnumber their transmissions and lightweight the vehicle. They all have very different plans. And here was an administration that said, we're not got to worry about 2025. We always got to worry about 2040 and 2050 in our goals, and we got to get to electrics eventually. Let's get it going before other countries do, and it just didn't work. This was a case where they should have set goals for the industry but not picked the technology and said, you guys pick the best way to get there, but get there, see? And that's what most executives and industry analysts are basically saying today.
So, David, this was a case of Washington kind of telling them how high to jump and playing the tune, but perhaps it was all the wrong tune?
Well, certainly there's no question that the U.S. government is committing an enormous sum of money to EVs. I mean, if you include the tax credits, the $7,500 tax credit that the government estimates over the next 10 years, it will cost it $7.5 billion. And you add to that the $5 billion or so in direct loans and grants to EVs and battery companies since 2009, we're talking about well in excess of $10 billion the government is committing to EVs. The main driver and why I'm not quite as pessimistic as Sean is I don't think they're going to disappear, at least in the near term, is because of California. California joined by 10 other states using its authority grandfathered in under the Clean Air Act, has the right to require or set its own emissions rules, which was upheld by the Supreme Court. And as a result, they have imposed a zero emission mandates, which start out very small, a few thousand vehicles, and will grow exponentially in the next few years. In fact, by 2040, California estimates that almost 90% of the vehicles will be zero emission, either full electric or hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. Now, they've changed that mandate multiple times, and they've watered it down, so it certainly could change. But because of this mandate, you're seeing companies bring EVs to market that they don't want to sell, like Chrysler is bringing a Fiat 500 EV. There's a lot of small EVs, the Ford Focus EV, which has only sold 700 cars in 14 months, is another example of selling these vehicles to meet this mandate. So as a result, these EVs are going to be out there in small numbers, and so the industry is sort of primed that if there was a big spike in gas prices or some other driver, tipping point, that they'd be ready to sell these in big numbers. But Sean's also right that the infrastructure is just not there. Yes, they're adding one, two, three, four, charging EV chargers here or there, which are fine for small numbers. But what happens if we suddenly have hundreds of EVs in certain cities or, they're just, the infrastructure is not prepared for dramatic numbers. For the one-off EVs, it's fine, but there's still a lot of problems. So short term, they're going to be around, I think. They're not going to die because of California, but the jury's out as to whether they have a long-term future.
Well, we have $9 a gallon gasoline in Europe, and we already have more recharging stations in the UK and France than we have electric vehicles, and they still won't sell. The product, David, is a bad product, and we've killed it off twice before. We didn't do it. The consumer did it. And even the Californians at ARB are reconsidering in a large way, I think, fuel cell vehicles is not 15, 20 years away, but less than 10, as the price is going to be below 50 in about a year's time. And there's a vehicle you can refill it up in 3 minutes and get 400-mile range.
For those of us who aren't familiar, tell us about the fuel cell.
Well, fuel cell is a hydrogen vehicle
that
runs on compressed hydrogen that can be made from many different sources. And it actually is converted to electricity and runs the same electric motors that would be in an electric car. The only barrier to fuel cell now is still obviously to reduce the cost of the technology on board to get it closer to electric vehicles. And second, there's enormous opposition from the energy industry, who, by the way, never saw electric cars as a threat to gasoline.
Which tells you something, doesn't
Absolutely
it?
Absolutely does. I mean, they see hydrogen as the threat. And they're refusing to install it and resisting the installation of hydrogen dispenser stations in California as we speak, and with every lawyer they've got. So
interesting.
A lot of technology should be tried. Eventually some will work, some won't. But the electric car, I think, has had its shot. And we've got to move on to some better solutions.
But just the problem with, of course, the hydrogen vehicles is that they have not met expectations either. I mean, GM, going back 20-odd years ago, has said, made big promises on how many fuel cell vehicles would be sold when they could bring the cost down. And now you have Honda and the German companies all vowing to bring fuel cells to market by 2015. I'm skeptical, given the history of advanced technologies, that those are doable. But you did see a pretty interesting announcement last week of three major auto companies, Nissan, Daimler, and Ford, saying they're going to work together on a hydrogen fuel cell project. So, long term, that technology has a lot of advantages. I agree with Sean. It doesn't have the range problem, the quick refueling. It's a lot more like gasoline, what Americans are used to. If the costs can come down, frankly, you may see something like China, which has a much more government-controlled economy, simply mandate big numbers of fuel cells, and maybe something like that could sort of lead the way in terms of U.S. adoption, to show that the fuel cells can work in big numbers. I mean, the other possibility, the EV advocates are going to say, if there was a big breakthrough in battery technology, which they've always claimed is around the corner, and you had much longer ranges and fast charging, which is coming, much shorter charges. I mean, Nissan has a charger that says you can recharge 80% of your Leaf in just 10 minutes. So if the range and the durability of the batteries gets significantly better, then I do think, and the cost comes down, then I do think EVs could succeed in the medium, short to medium term. But that, again, there's a lot of ifs there.
And we see these battery suppliers either barely staying afloat or going bankrupt. So it doesn't seem there's a lot of vibrancy in that. And I want to go back. Sean, you flinched when David said China, about China. Amanda, you just kind of, your thoughts on that.
Well, actually, China is a place for electric cars. They're finding some consumer resistance. You can get a license plate in Shanghai or Beijing only if you're buying an electric car at this point. That's how bad the environmental problem is in those cities with their rapid ramp-up in the use of automotive products, to say the least, with 25 million people.
Yeah.
They really don't have much choice. you know, one of the reasons we were supposed to invest in companies like A123 mm-hmm. with both federal and state of Michigan money was to stay ahead of the Chinese. And, of course, we know the story now. They're being sold to the Chinese with some technical restrictions, but this is enormous irony, even worse than Solyndra. Nobody sold Solyndra to the Chinese, and the Chinese beat them. But now we're even selling these battery plants, these empty battery plants where there's no demand. I mean, there's other solutions. Compressed natural gas is getting another look.
And we're finding more natural gas reserves.
Oh, enormously so. And there's new innovations coming on keeping it on board the vehicle. And it's cheaper. It's a cheaper infrastructure problem than electric. And you know what's really going to clobber the hybrids this year will be these better internal combustion engines. The revenge of the internal combustion engine, these small four-cylinder motors and better technologies and transmissions and other technologies in the vehicle and lightweighting that won't give you an economic reason for a very long while for the vast majority of Americans to buy an electric. It's that competition, which I think David knows about, that's most surprising of all.
But I would say this about hybrids and EVs is that there is a small number of people, and remember, the car you drive is one of the ways you say things about yourself, and that's why companies spend so much money branding these vehicles. And there's a small number of people who are environmentally motivated who wanted to buy the Toyota Prius because they wanted to send a message that I'm green. And that's one of the reasons that Prius has been pretty much the only successful hybrid that's been sold in the United States. You know, initially you saw that effort with the Leaf and, you know, ads with polar bears and a polar bear hugging a Leaf owner and thanking them for helping to reduce global warming. And there is a small market, you know, and there's a very sort of loyal, you know, group. The problem is everybody, the media, the auto companies, everybody thought, you know, or most people thought there would be a larger market by this point. I mean, nobody thought that everybody would disappoint, and everybody has disappointed from GM, you know, Nissan, Ford, Tesla, Fisker, these two startups, and, you know, who have gotten hundreds of millions of dollars in government money to build EVs and plug-ins. So it is hard to not be pessimistic about the future, but it also took hybrids. It took Toyota 10 years to sell a million hybrids in the U.S., and it was a very slow ramp up. And then many people dismissed it. So it's still possible that EVs could surprise people. Sean, don't you think one thing I've always thought is the basic technology, what are we driving around today, is basically the same internal combustion engine with some improvements that we were driving 100 years ago. But again, unless there's a value added, unless there's a way that people can see a big benefit, either through gas prices or environmental reasons or something to convince them, or tax policy, or, you know, free travel and HOV lanes like California is doing to boost sales, the internal combustion engine has had a pretty good run, and everybody agrees at least for the next 40 years they're going to have a very large share of the market.
Sean, you get the last word.
I would say yes, we still have four wheels and a motor in the front generally, and it runs on fossil fuel. But there have been a lot of other improvements, and I'm very optimistic about what this industry can do in regards to fuel economy over the next 10 years. And electrics will always have a niche. They're not going to go away. I mean, they've developed enough in the last 3 years that all those nice environmentally conscious people in the 50 campus towns in San Francisco and in L.A. and Boston and New York will have their choice, okay? But it's just not going to be the choice of the other 97%.
David Shepherdson is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News, and he's joined us from Washington. And then here in the studio, Dr. Sean McElinden, Executive VP of Research and Chief Economist at the Center for Auto Research. Thanks for a great conversation to both of you.
Thanks. Appreciated it.
And, of course, we love hearing from you here at Stateside. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show or stories you think we should cover, people you think we should profile. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Go to the Stateside link. On Facebook, just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And, of course, on Twitter at Stateside Radio.
Our show today was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. The program engineer today by Peg Watson. Our contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Maya Friedman, and Austin Davis. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow afternoon at 3:00.